Good morning and welcome to the Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists. If you haven't picked up a periodical, please do so. It has our schedule within. We meet twice a week, Sunday mornings, obviously. The doors open at 10:30. The meeting is from 11 to 12. And we are this summer, for July and September, taking a series of articles by Madame Blavatsky and William Q. Judge that relate to self-development. The other meeting is on Wednesday evenings. We are open from 5:30 to 7:30 with a reference library. And then from 7:45 to 9, we study one of the all-time spiritual treasures, the Bhagavad Gita. It is, we've completely lost a word that would cover it. It is alive and vibrant and as meaningful to any one of us as it was when it was composed 5,000 years ago. It is the psychological study of the soul in evolution. We encourage anyone to come. You don't need to be a Sanskrit scholar. It's in English. You don't need to be anything except willing to listen and learn. So that meeting is from 7:45 to 9. Every meeting at this lodge or any United Lodge of Theosophists is given out on the basis of associates working together to provide freely. No dues, no fees, no registration, nothing but your presence is required to be part of these meetings. And the only requirement as far as acceptance, or what someone might call belief, is the realization that universal brotherhood is a fact, not a utopia, it's a fact. And to go against it harms ourselves as well as others. So as an association of students, we are entirely supported by voluntary donations of time and effort and study, and of course money. We have to keep the building open. But any donation you make goes only to that purpose. There are no salaries, there's no money used in any way except to keep the meetings available. So we encourage you to read the declaration, which is the policy as stated on the back of our lodge periodical. The method of work is perhaps the most truly open and independent you've ever read in your life. If you wanted to join with associates here, the card you would sign reads, "Being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge as set forth in its declaration," and of course that's the giving out of the original writings, "I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate, it being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I, myself, determine." Now, this morning, we're studying Practical Occultism by H.P. Blavatsky, and we will have some of the paragraphs summarized, and then we're open for discussion.
Right, so we're going to summarize a few of the paragraphs, although you may find that some of the summary is actually verbatim because we couldn't figure out a better way to say it. So in the future, if you choose to come on Sundays, it might be helpful to find out what the articles are and go on the internet and read prior to coming. But nevertheless, that's why we summarize them to get the meeting going for those who have not had opportunity to read. So, a statement is made somewhere in this article. There's a difference between theoretical occultism and practical occultism, or what we call theosophy, theoretical occultism, and occult science, which is practical occultism. Now, it's easy to become a theosophist. Any person of average intellectual abilities, a leaning toward the metaphysical, who lives a pure, unselfish life, who finds joy in helping his neighbor, more so than in receiving help himself, one who's ready to sacrifice his own pleasures for the sake of others, and who loves truth, goodness, and wisdom without anything but just loving it for their own sake, or without benefits that truth and wisdom may confer back to the individual. Such is a theosophist. But what about the path that leads to specific knowledge, a right discrimination of good from evil? That path which leads one to the power through which he can do good for others, often without even apparently lifting a finger. Along this path are teachers who accept enormous responsibility for their students or for the sake of their pupil. An inviolable occult law for these teachers subjects the teachers who would teach this occult science openly or secretly, whether a guru of the East or a Kabbalist of the West. And we speak of so-called teachers of this occult science, no matter how knowledgeable and no matter how ignorant they may be of this inviolable law of taking responsibility for the student who they teach. Such teachers take on all the sins of the pupil from the moment they begin really to teach matters that are connected with the occult science. This, whether the students have sins of commission or sins of omission, is the case until the pupil himself becomes a master and is fully responsible in his turn. Such an occult law is the basis for the absolute sacred yet symbolic relationship between godparents and godchildren of the early Orthodox Christian churches. Thus, it is clear why the teacher does not appear until the student is ready, and why students must serve years of probation to prove their fitness to the teachers. Occultism is not magic per se. Magic can mean many different things to many different people, but occultism is not magic per se. One can learn the trick of spells and the methods of using subtle forces of his physical nature. One can use the power of his animal or magnetic nature when he awakens it. The forces of love and hate and passion can be called into operation, but this can all be sorcery or black magic. It is impossible to employ spiritual forces if there's the slightest tinge of selfishness remaining in the operator. It is motive alone which makes the exercise of any power to become beneficent or malignant, white magic or black magic. Unless one's intention is entirely pure, the spiritual efforts degrade into psychic efforts, and they act on the astral plane, not on the spiritual plane, and this may result in tragedy. Our animal magnetism can be used for good or evil, but the powers and forces of spirit lend themselves only to the perfectly pure in heart, and this is divine magic. So for the rest of the time, there'll be questions and discussion invited from the group.
Based on that summary, however, we do begin to see why this article would be chosen for self-development. Usually people are interested in developing some sort of powers, and this is a direct warning why that is a mistake. Now, if you've had a chance to read it, yes.
Coming across this argument, we wanted to historical records of people being of this nature.
What do you mean, as the teachers or the students?
No, as being pure souls. And in the writings of Porphyry and Imbricus and all those Neoplatonists, they talk of Porphyry being of such a pure nature that he had union with his higher nature several times. And they talk of other philosophers at that time that did the same. How does one approach this knowledge?
You mean getting to that point? How?
Well, we have to start somewhere.
Yes, and all right. Where do we start? Yes.
Well, Mr. Judge says in the philosophy that step one along this path is to lead a virtuous life, which is to say, to lead a life of moral courage, to be willing to do what you know is right in spite of what anybody else may think, and be willing to accept the karmic effects of that, for if you, whether you perceive it good or ill, but do what's right anyway. And that sets up certain causes to take on to the next step.
And why would that be reasonable to act that way? You know, in many articles, Theosophy points out the fact that we are told to be good and we're not given any real reason why. The reason we should be virtuous is that that reflects our true nature. We have a personal self, but we are spiritual beings using that personal self. And until we become, as you described it, virtuous and clear-seeing, we're colored and influenced by all of the sensations and the personal feelings. So the first thing, the first realization, what would that have to be? And being in this room, every one of you must have had that. Yes?
As this has been stated in the general introduction by Omi Pio, because brotherhood, brotherhood is a fact.
Yes.
And if we can believe that and live that, that's the start.
Yes. If we could live by the golden rule, there, we would not need the word virtue. It would just be natural. Nothing to compare it to. But until we realize that we are other than what we've been taught, which is, you know, the materialistic idea that we only exist as the moving molecules in the brain, and when the brain is gone, the illusion of us is gone. Or the religious idea that we are subject to the mercy or grace or interference or involvement of some other being, either God gracing us or Jesus saving us. Again, that demeans the soul, who is a spiritual being on the way to becoming as the Buddha was, as the Christ was. So first we have to have that realization, then the effort to make those virtues. Yes?
Well, the word believe was used a few seconds ago. And most of our life we believed in something. We've always believed in something. So we were like going forward until we became disillusioned, because our beliefs were not based on sound ideas. We come to Theosophy, and there's like one idea that it talks about constantly, and it has like two aspects. But can we prove it to ourselves that we are all linked together, that everything is one?
Go ahead.
Well, you have to start with the premise of what, or you know, our the reality that we live in this oneness, this space that we occupy, this body we occupy, and this universe, and beyond the universe. So God can't be anything that I can imagine, because God, or that idea, has to be limitless.
We think the easiest searching is to then ask yourself, who and what am I? And if you start with, okay, I am the physical body. Well, that can't be true, because I have the same sense of identity that I had when I was 5 or 6. If that I remains through all those changes of physical substance every 7 years, science tells us, then what is that I? It can't be the physical. And we can go through all of the conditions. It can't be the mental. How many times have I changed my mind and my opinion and my feelings? We finally come to the realization that that I is permanent, enduring. No one gave it to us. No one woke you up and said, hey, you're I, just like I am I. And when we finally come to that realization that it is changeless, no matter what experiences we've been through, we realize it must be the same for everyone, no matter what condition they're in, whether they have just murdered an entire village, they are still a spiritual being. And because that I is real, karma, the law, the universal law of cause and effect that we see clearly on the physical plane, nobody assumes that water will burn and fire will run downhill. We know how physical things act. It's law. It's order. That law equally works on our moral nature. So the one who has committed these horrible crimes will receive the just and perfect punishment. For what purpose? To educate that soul. Karma is always the return of what we made others feel, so that we know why that should never be done. It is educational. So once we begin to really realize that that sense of brotherhood is not just a sense, it is a reality, we will still be a little stupid and clumsy and act against it often, sometimes for reasons we don't even understand in ourselves. But the fact is, once the soul recognizes that we are all one, it is on the path to learning. And teachers appear as we go along, either in books or friends or strangers. Yes?
The question passes our minds then. Do we make contracts prior to our reincarnation in this life?
Oh, that's interesting.
to learn something from a prior karmic debt.
Well, when you said contract, do you mean literally with ourselves?
No, not with our small selves.
With the higher nature.
Yes.
You don't have to make a contract with what you are. You don't. Just like you don't have to wake up in the morning and say, oh, who am I? Who am I? I am I. You are that, so you don't have to register it, claim it. You are it. You can act from it on a higher basis, or you can act in the lower personal basis. But when the soul is awakening from the after-death heaven-like dream that it has experienced, it isn't making any choices. All choices are made here. How we think and act here determines, usually not the life so much that you are in, except physical karma, but your future lives. So you are making a contract in that sense with nature. You're saying, this is what I want. I want this, and that's why I am pursuing it with this effort and desire. So the after-death state, that awakening, is extremely important. It is said that we see clearly as spiritual beings. We are the higher ego, and we know what is to come because we, better than anyone, know exactly how we have acted and why. We see the justice of it, and we move into it joyfully because we want to experience the karma to be free of the problem so we can go on. You had your hand. Yeah.
You were thinking the idea of karma.
sometimes.
No, really, in the majority of the time, we were thinking because we really never die.
Mm-hmm.
We really never, when we go to sleep at night, we don't go to sleep at night. This physical form goes to sleep. But I have consciousness in maybe quite a few dreams, one long dream during the night. And it's obvious that there has been proof that there are those who in deep sleep have gotten some enlightenment and brought it back
mm-hmm.
to this consciousness upon awakening. So that's a
powerful realization.
Sensation to think about that my consciousness never stops.
We can't. That's what we are. We are mind beings. How can we ever be unconscious? It's just we move from plane to plane and then back again, all for the point of learning. Yes?
With respect to the previous contribution and the question regarding contracts, in a sense, one can make a contract with oneself, but it might be more helpful to think of the word vow instead of contract.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between the two words, very simply, is that a contract between two parties, if one party breaks the contract,
mm-hmm.
the other party is free to do as he sees and avoid the contract. But in a vow, typically, which is held in philosophical or
right.
religious context, when a vow is made between two, such as marriage vows, the idea is even if someone breaches the vow, the other one is still morally and spiritually obligated to fulfill the vow to the best of their ability, and they're not released from it. So the expectation is that both are going to adhere to the vow. And we've read in the philosophy that when one vows to his higher self, which carries him through lifetimes, that the higher self is always there, and the opportunity always repeats itself for the personality
right.
in new lifetimes.
No, not for the personality, the individuality. Yeah. With the terms, it's if only we were here speaking Sanskrit, we'd all understand everything much more quickly because it's much more detailed to the reality as things are. We think the reality is this hard and fast substance. We think the reality is our personal nature. We think we're all separate from each other. So we're dealing in complete confusion, and we've made a contract, in a sense, with a sort of adolescent yearning. We love the personal, the physical, the sensational. And because that's true, we've blocked our own real awareness as a spiritual being. And as was said, we may pick it up in deep sleep and wake with a feeling of peace and comfort. Yes?
Aren't we constantly reminded, we live on this ball, this globe, and we have day and night, seasons
mm-hmm.
of the year, but in the seasons we see, like, the summer solstice, the fall equinox, the winter solstice, and the spring equinox. Are there not energies that we can use to help us? Because I know you come to class this year during New Year's and it's spoken of making a resolution,
mm-hmm.
and especially at that time of year, that it gives you have an impulse from nature that will aid us.
Well, just as we see the physical changes in nature, Theosophy teaches us that there is an inner change that goes on. And in the period of the winter solstice, the astral life of the earth is young and powerful. And because it is, and we are part of that, we can use it to strengthen ourselves. So vows to yourself, promises to yourself made at that time of year have much more powerful chance of succeeding if we keep a couple of things in mind. We're told never make a negative resolution. don't say, I am not going to swear anymore, because the very resolution brings up the thing you don't want to do anymore. Instead, make it a positive one. I will not be vulgar in my speech. That's quite different. So you're talking about a different behavior. So no negative resolutions. Never make a resolution that you have not pondered and well thought out so that you know you intend to keep it. It is said we weaken our willpower every time we make a declaration like that and then we just toss it aside. So it's a very serious thing to make that kind of commitment and promise. And it is said by the time that the spring equinox comes, all of those seeds that you planted in that resolution will then bloom, and you will have them with you the rest of your incarnation, unless you take different steps in between. Yes?
Further down in the article, one of the rules, number 9, talks about how an individual who's going to follow along the lines of occult science must adhere to universal truths in nature. And it distinguishes something called the doctrine of the heart from the doctrine of the eye. Could we investigate the differences between the heart doctrine and the mind doctrine?
Okay. Let's hear from some of you. What would be the heart doctrine versus the eye doctrine? Yes?
Well, we think Buddha exemplified the heart doctrine. He was a great compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So his life, being a compassionate being, is an example that he set for the world,
mm-hmm.
of the heart doctrine.
Yes?
Or read Mr. Judge.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In the back?
Or we could say it's a feeling or a knowing that I didn't pick up out of books and stuff. It's a knowing.
Okay. Yes?
Am I what I see? Or am I the one looking at myself?
What do we think of when we think of the heart?
Love.
Love. Feeling. But feeling comes from thought, doesn't it? I mean, you can't have a feeling without some thought that's associated with it. What do we do with the eye? Observe. And again, you have a thought. In actuality, these two phrases represent religion versus science. But for the student of theosophy, they represent the way of the soul, the individuality, the reincarnating ego, versus the way of the personal life. In the personal life, we're competitive, aren't we? I mean, even in grade school, weren't we competitive with each other? We go for the best grade. We want everything to come our way. We want to be successful. That doesn't require any of the doctrine of the heart. As a matter of fact, true intellectualism requires you to be cold and detached, or you can't pursue it in its purity. The doctrine of the heart does not say that you should be stupid, but it says that everything is referred back to that higher feeling, that love for humanity should be our basis. And granted, it's difficult to love like that. So we begin where we find ourselves. And we find ourselves learning to deal with situations we don't like, people we don't like, personalities we don't like, and realizing about those conditions that the problem is in us, not in the individual or the situation. So it's a question of growing to universal ideas, to realizing that everything you meet is yourself. If you don't like it, change that in yourself. Yes?
When we read
It just means psychic powers, and they're number 12. It is only by virtue of a strict observance of the foregoing rules that a Lanu can hope to acquire in good time the cities of the Arhats, the growth which makes him become gradually one with the universal all. In other words, there are higher powers. What would you think are some of the higher spiritual powers? Yes?
Compassion.
Compassion. Altruism. Well, they're higher, but can we use them and have them right now? And if not, why not? Why don't we just bloom forth with compassion? Yes?
It's the ideas that we hold. We separate ourselves by the. We think we are these lies. All these feelings that come, how can we not? Our whole life is led by the feelings. And
some of it is fear. Fear of being ridiculed. Fear of being taken advantage of. One of our biggest problems these days is you are absolutely inundated with every terrible thing that's happening all over the world. Nobody's showing you all the unbelievable brilliance of compassion that's being shown all over the world. There are so many Americans, young Americans, working in the strangest places, doing the most wonderful, compassionate, generous things with their lives. We don't hear about that. We may hear about an incident, like the man last week that made that incredible rescue. There was a car on fire. The man couldn't get out of the car, and it was clear that he was about to die. The other man ran over and grabbed the metal on the burning car door and pulled it off so that he could get to the window and pull the man out. And everybody was, you know, overawed and interviewing him, and he was like, anybody would have done that. You know, just leave me alone. Because that soul-to-soul recognition is there. And we are not told about it. We're just told about the terrible things that are happening. We have to look for and encourage the opposite. And we don't mean entertainment news. I don't know who ever gave the word news to entertainment stories, but we have lost something. It's really sad. Not to push a particular thing, but if you find the BBC on your telly, as they would say, watch their news. You will discover that most Europeans are more sophisticated about what's going on in this country politically and financially because they get a very clear picture. They don't get the kind of news that we get. Yes?
Well, Al Jazeera also.
Pardon?
Al Jazeera is a news.
Yes, the
channel that gives another perspective on the world that we don't get very often.
And we should. We should be more well-rounded about all of the information. But at the same time, we have to have time for self-development. And what would you say that articles like this add to that need for an education of developing the higher in you? How does this article help at all? Yes?
Struggle because we live in a world of sensation. So article certainly gives you some kind of satisfaction, some kind of knowing that there is a soul life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you concentrate on it,
and the realization that to take on the role of teacher or to really take on the role of student is a very serious thing. This is not lightly done. We have to bring ourselves to a point or to a pitch where we can be trusted with knowledge and power. If we're going to develop the discrimination that we need, we have to begin in our own daily lives. We don't have to rush off and seek something else. We already have the perfect instrument here. It's this animal nature, and we're supposed to be in charge of it. Instead, it runs away with us. So we have the perfect thing for study and the perfect method. Meditation and concentration. Observing yourself in action and trying to discover your motives. You had your hand up.
We were talking about compassion a little while ago, and we understand that compassion is a power of the soul. And what we think that it has to do with occult science is very much in the process of someone goes through this along this path, is that whether or not you're on that path, you have that power. The question is, you know, how bright and strong is it within you? Or in other words, compassion is, you know, your ability to identify with the challenges that someone else is experiencing and therefore to be able to perfectly help them along their path. Well, it would seem the further along the path an individual goes, the more he understands his inner life. And therefore, the more he would be able to be more fully compassionate and be able to be of service to others. So when they say, you know, don't criticize till you walk a mile in someone's moccasins, a person who is perfectly evolved actually could walk the mile in another's moccasins so that he can know how to perfectly help others and be of service.
Actually, we think one of the most difficult things to learn is when to not help others. Many times out of compassion, we jump in too soon. And that would be like someone carrying around their young child until they went to school. They never touched the ground. Well, that does not help the child develop muscles or the ability to steer clear of problems. It creates a handicapped child. And in many ways, that's what we're dealing with ourselves. We are handicapped in many ways because of the ideas we hold, because of what we accept as the right thing to do and the right way to do it. And we need to reevaluate all that. So we have to begin with compassion for ourselves. We didn't set out to be stupid or cruel or clumsy. We just end up that way in many ways. And that's good, because once the soul realizes it has a problem, it's halfway to solving it. You can't fix something you don't see. So the very fact that we question ideas means that we are open to growth. Yes?
Just a phrase we often hear, the term, look out.
Well, Theosophy says, no, look in. You will find within yourself that permanent, enduring self. Once you actually see it, you can never deny it to yourself. And once you actually take the position, all right, if I am a changeless spiritual being and this personality, this physical body, all of these characteristics are temporary. They're something I'm using. They're the tools for experience. But I am separate from them. And if I don't want to act in a certain way, my body, my personality cannot make me act that way. I can use my will. Do it once. Prove it to yourself once. And you are at the bottom of the world's most beautiful mountain, where you realize, I really have the power. Nothing can happen without my permission. I let the personality run wild, it runs wild. I pull it back, and I may not be able to keep it back, but I pull it back just once, and I learn, and I can start by changing the ideas I hold, and that will change the response. Yes?
Yes, but then there seems to be an army of foes that come and confront us and surround us.
Good.
When we say, well, I'm not judging based on perceived, I'm looking within myself. And then when we see a vast army of radiant joys prevent us from doing the right
Epictetus, everybody should read Epictetus because he becomes like your best friend, just shaking his head going, I can't believe you did that. Epictetus said, where would Hercules have been if he hadn't had any foes? Well, he'd be sitting in the barn, sleeping, daydreaming. We should celebrate our foes, our problems, because they awaken us to take action, to do something. If we really understood it, we would see that the foe or the army against us is just a mirror. It's reflecting everything in us we don't want to know, we don't want to see. All the things we have to get rid of in ourselves in order to make another step up. So it's a foe, an adversary, thank goodness. Yes?
To different people, the word, so the title for today's discussion is
practical,
occultism.
Right.
And that word occultism can mean so many different things,
mm-hmm.
to so many different people, especially if you really don't know what theosophy is and you go flying through the internet, think we're worshiping the devil or something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me that this article is making a distinction between theosophy,
yes.
and occultism.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, it seems like you can learn something about occultism and theosophy. And what are the similarities or differences, or what's important to know?
This is a quote from HPB that's not in this article. It should never be forgotten that occultism is concerned with the inner man who must be strengthened and freed from the dominion of the physical body and its surroundings, which must become his servants. Any man or woman can set himself or herself to study the specified occult arts with any great previous preparation, and even without adopting any too restraining mode of life. One could even dispense with any lofty standard of morality. In the last case, of course, 10 to 1, the student would blossom into a very decent kind of sorcerer and tumble down headlong into black magic. In other words, you can be a theosophist without being an occultist, but you better not be an occultist without being a theosophist. That realization of the spiritual reality of life, of your identity with all souls, is absolutely necessary before you ever take up any kind of practice. Yes? Way in the back.
We really want to know what is the best way for me to go without becoming selfish or black.
Oh, you don't have to become selfish. We all are. We all already are selfish. We've made an art of it in the West.
Well, that's so very, very true. And Bhagavad Gita is a story, but it's said that if we read and understand that, that's true.
But it also says that if we read it and don't understand it, but feel the beauty of it, we are still being spiritually cleansed, in a sense. We have this notion, usually, that we're waiting for something to be given to us, that we have to be presented with spirituality, wisdom. But those things are natural to us. We already are that. We are a spiritual being, caught up in the web of learning and experiencing through the physical, through the astral. So we're all confused and we misuse our powers. There is no opposite, like evil. We think there's good and evil. No, there's just the soul making choices. Where it's for the benefit of life, we label it good. Where it's for a selfish, degrading purpose, we label it evil. But in either case, it's just experience. You know, in the Light of Asia, there's that wonderful little segment or stanza where it says, virtues grow weak over time, and sins grow purged thereby. In other words, the worst thing we have ever done is eventually purged from us because we change. We set up conditions where that can't abide in us anymore. And virtues, we lose them because we are interested in something else. So we are a dynamic being. And until we take control of that, and we take control of it starting where we find ourselves, the beginning of a spiritual journey is first and foremost selfish, because I want to know, I want to see that this is, life is spiritual, that I am one with others. It's me I'm concerned about. But the more I grow and learn, the more I realize there is no me. There is the illusion that I, as a thinker, am separate. Yes?
We often go over the history of some of our ancestors who were young people in the late 19th century. And we are amazed at the simplicity of their thinking, their philosophy, and so forth. And then we thought how easy it was for us to simplify mathematical equations.
Wish I'd known you. Well, our education usually gets in the way of the very ideas that we are talking about. We're denied our spiritual reality. We have to look elsewhere. But it happens in the opposite way, like in India. You would think that they would have a much easier time. But in another way, they have gone too far the other way and become... for many, many years, caste-driven and superstitious and rites and ritual following. So that there are traps on either end, but the soul stands in the center, learning from any condition if it wills to. And the more simple, the better off we are. Yes?
Well, honestly, you find this whole presentation very, very helpful, very much.
No, why? An idea doesn't belong to the person who's giving it out. The reason we have the names of the publishers or the writers, authors of these articles is that we hold them in esteem and reverence. If you take the writings and teachings of HPV and Judge, you will find they are logical and consistent all the way through. You will also find they both say they're not the authors of anything they wrote. They are the students of wiser beings, and this is what they have learned, and they pass it on to you freely. So they do not claim to be teachers or great writers or great spiritual beings, but good students, very good students. Well, that's what we try to be. Yes, we all have a name, we all have a personality, and we do get to know each other that way. But when it comes to the platform, the giving out of the teachings, we don't own them, we didn't create them. If we make a mistake in stating them, which of course can happen, it's up to other students in the audience to say, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly the way it's stated. Because we're an association of students, we are here for only one purpose, to share what we have learned. Yes?
I think the speaker's name is not important, but I do think the speaker might be an adept.
How would we know that? No, now...
I don't know for sure.
No, but seriously, how would one know anything? Let's say you walk into a room and everybody says to you, that's the great scientist. And they're pointing to someone. How would you know for yourself that it was true? Well, if you were introduced, you heard their name, and you went, oh yeah, I tried to read one of his books, and I know what the world thinks of him. So we go by others' opinions and kind of collective consciousness. But when it comes to an adept, adepts don't write books. Adepts don't go around publishing their name. How would you know? Well, how do you know the wisest person in your family? Maybe it's your grandmother or your grandfather, your great aunt. How do you know they're wise? Yes? No, I want an answer to that question first.
Their calmness.
Their kindness. We could go to them with any problem, and they're going to take us slowly back to the simplicity of it, that we're making it all complicated. And they're going to deal with our feelings and our reactions. They show us their wisdom. Well, if someone is an adept, we would never know it on this plane. Because you have to be equal to something to recognize it. If you have a practice of some kind, you're a great pianist, let's say, you would recognize another great pianist immediately. You would know the training, the discipline, everything that went into it, as well as the expression of the beauty of their craft. But the rest of us might not have that kind of subtlety of recognition. But is it important that someone is an adept? It is to them, and that is their effort and their energy. But the minute they would go around boasting about it, they would no longer be an adept. You had your hand.
Walk into a conference with a psychic, a good one that really does it, philosophy, is that person considered a practical occultist?
Not if you take the word practical to mean the practice of the soul in evolution. They're several steps down from it and have created for themselves a condition that they are going to have to work around. One of the biggest problems in having any sort of power, and many people are born with them, is that there is a feeling, even if it's half conscious, I am more spiritual than someone else because I have these powers. And that is not true. It is, I have invested time and energy in this lesser work, and I have that skill. And I have to learn right here and now how to control it. If it really were necessary for the soul to know something, they will be warned in dreams. Or, as we read in the transactions, another may have a dream for you because you're not impressionable. Caesar's wife, don't go to the Senate today. He, of course, ignored her. The fact is that if it is necessary, if for the sake of the soul's growth, we will be warned in inner ways. We will have a sense. We know someone who was offering great sums of money to a taxi driver to get them to the airport in time and just missed the flight and was furious, and yet that plane crashed. So we never know why things interfere and obstruct us, and they can be good. But we don't want to go after those powers. If it's necessary for us to know, we will know. We wanted to end with this from HPB. We are in the Kali Yuga, which is the Iron Age, which began with the death of Krishna 5,000 years ago. And its fatal influence is a thousandfold more powerful in the West than it is in the East. Hence the easy praise made by the powers of the Age of Darkness in this cyclic struggle, and the many delusions under which the world is now laboring. One of these is the relative facility with which men fancy they can get at the gate and cross the threshold of occultism without any great sacrifice. It is the dream of those inspired by desire for power and personal selfishness, and it is not such feelings that can ever lead them to the coveted goal. And that coveted goal is to be a perfected soul. But it doesn't happen through having psychic powers. Now, we remind you that next Sunday, it's Mental Discipline, an article by Mr. Judge, and you may pick a copy of it up on your way out, so you can read it ahead of time if you like. And if you are coming next Sunday, we ask you to bring it back. Meeting is adjourned.